from KQED. Hey there, everyone. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Guy Marzorati, in this week for Scott Schaefer.
Holding down the fort for Scott.
The boss is not in the building.
Today, we're going to bring you our conversation with someone who may be spending a little more time in California in 2019.
That's right. We talked recently with New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, one of a few different Democrats considering a run for president.
And, of course, they're all going to be headed to the Golden State if they have their eyes on 2020, because we not only have the money here, but guess what? We're going to have an early presidential primary.
We are. And you know what? Can I just say a little like PSA for all the candidates? Forget about the fundraising in Silicon Valley and West LA. Forget about the obligatory double-double In-N-Out and the Carol C. special at Roscoe's. Come here. Come to Political Breakdown.
Come to KQED.
We can't promise anything in return but a good time, but our mics are open.
We do promise a good time. I mean, I think almost without fail, our guests always say, that was really fun. So, you know,
facts.
And there's some good food around here. I don't know. Something like that. Well, that's still 2 years off, although it feels like it's already happening. But you know what did happen this week? New legislature was sworn in Sacramento.
That's right. And we were there up at the Capitol on Monday to see the swearing in of new assembly members, senators, and then right away, some new bills coming down the pike. I know you've been following a lot of the coverage of the bills on wildfires. And what's interesting to me about that, I feel like, is a lot of times we see the legislature take things up kind of in pushes. They make a push on environmental legislation, a push on housing legislation. They made a push on wildfire-related legislation at the end of the year, but it still felt even then like there was still way more to be done right when they get back.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is such a complicated issue. It hits so many areas of government. Like, we're talking about, you know, how... Obviously, there's been a big discussion over utilities sparking fires and sort of how to prevent fires from starting. But then there's these other buckets, like what happens once a fire actually hits and how do you get people out safely and how do you tell them it's coming? So there's that angle. And then there's like, how do you, knowing that these fires are becoming worse because of climate change and drought, make sure that communities are prepared for them? And so I think what's fascinating to me is that so much of, you know, the oxygen kind of got sucked out of the room around the question of utilities, particularly PG&E, and who's going to pay for this stuff. And that was this year. Looking forward, certainly that's looming over this legislature, but I think what we're already seeing, and I wrote about two bills that were rolled out this week, is more attention being paid in those other buckets, so to speak. So one of the ones that really fascinated me was Assemblymember Jim Wood, whose district runs all the way, you know, from basically Santa Rosa up to the Oregon border along the coast. He wants to create a revolving fund to help homeowners basically harden their homes against fires. So low, no interest loans, you know, kind of taking a page from what we've seen around other disasters. And the idea that the state could step in around earthquake, you know, seismic retrogrades, or in other states, you have the option of things like federal insurance, you know, FEMA insurance against hurricanes. And so, you know, I'm going to be watching, of course, the conversation around all this and with an eye on PG&E. But I think also it'll be kind of one of those things where we're going to see a lot more of these approaches that are looking to really get the state involved in these broader issues, not just about preventing the fires, but kind of living with fire. You know, I got a question this week at a business group about CEQA reform and will we see environmental reform? And I was like, you know, that's funny because I think the wildfires may pose an opening for that because we've already seen some CEQA exemptions around forest management. So, yeah, a lot to unpack there. But again, you know, not the issue I think Gavin Newsom was raring to start his term on, but clearly a huge one.
There's no way to avoid that. But I do think there's ties between the wildfire issues and housing, which is stuff I've really been following, because I think these situations, tragically, when towns are kind of burned to the ground, you see, you know, an ability to look at a place and say, OK, if starting from scratch, basically, what are ways in which we can rebuild? And a lot of times that means getting rid of requirements around CEQA and certain other regulatory requirements because there needs to be a speeding up of the process. And, you know, onto the housing legislation I've really been following. You talked about the PG&E thing really taking up the oxygen in the wildfire utility world. In housing, it's really been SB 50 from Scott Wiener. This is a bill that's being tried again. It was an idea
second
tried
run.
Last year, a second run, an idea tried last year around mandating more density around transit stops. This year's version is mandating more density in some places, not even around transit stops. But it looks like he has more of the organized labor on board and some maybe some low-income housing advocates that he didn't last time around. But again, I think because so much of so many of the proposals around low-income housing and housing for the homeless will really be tied up in the budget, I think the early discussions are you're going to see a lot of focus on a bill like this, which is really on the regulatory side.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you wrote also about redevelopment and sort of whispers of that coming back, or at least in some form. You know, I think this governor is going to be more focused on housing, again, out of necessity, but also, you know, because when Jerry Brown came in, he had a budget deficit. He had other things. I mean, the housing and affordability crisis is really top of mind, even as the economy booms.
Well, I think just talking to a number of Democratic lawmakers, they really see Gavin Newsom kind of as their meal ticket to all the proposals they couldn't get past Jerry Brown, you know, the last 8 years. I do think it's going to be interesting. The early comments we've seen from Newsom maybe seems like he's not ready to embrace that role. You know, I think he wants to maintain that fiscal stewardship.
Yeah, everyone's playing really nice right now.
True.
Like, you go out to try to do an interview about something like, what do you think Newsom will do on this? And lawmakers, even ones who maybe didn't support him, are like, well, we're just going to see. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. So, you know, newsflash, Gavin's been in the game a while, but it is the honeymoon phase right now. And I think once the legislature starts in earnest in January, that little, you know, that rosy feeling may fade pretty quickly. But until then, enjoy it, Gavin.
Yeah.
All right. We are going to take a short break and come back with our recent interview with New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Guy Marzorati, here with Marisa Lagos.
And we are thrilled to be joined here in California by an out-of-state guest, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. Welcome to Political Breakdown.
Thank you.
So you're in California to promote your children's book, which is about women suffragettes who, you know, helped push the women's movement forward. Why'd you write this book and why now?
Well, I thought the stories of these women were so inspiring to me personally. I wanted to tell them for the next generation, for young girls and boys. And their stories of determination, of courage, of extraordinary bravery, of vision. And I thought they were as important today as they were then. And I think these are stories that can serve as role models for anyone who reads about these women, because they really did persevere through very difficult challenges.
Speaking of role models, you have more than a few female role models in your own family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's kind of incredible going back generations. It seems like you have women in your family who really kind of set a path for you to go out in the world and have such high aspirations.
They really did. And the reason why I started the book with a little bit of my own family is because I wanted that young reader to know she or he probably has some pretty good role models in their own families. My children both had to do a project where they had to look into their heritage. And I had so much fun doing that with both of them. It's a fifth grade project. And so in fifth grade at the kids' school, they do it. And I loved going back and finding out what our parents and grandparents, great-grandparents accomplished and did and achieved. And so I just thought if I could give a little vignette about my mother and how she inspired me, because
she has a pretty incredible
story. She always
story.
Dared to be different. She was one of only three women in her law school class, and literally five out of six of my best girlfriends, we all became lawyers because she was one of our best role models.
And then, she was pregnant in law school?
In law school. Her criminal law final was the day that she was supposed to give birth to my brother.
Wow.
And so she had to take it later, and her mother had to watch her to make sure she took it from her bed.
And let's talk about the black belt.
Yeah, and my mom, you know, instead of playing tennis like, you know, a lot of moms might consider would be a great choice, she decided to become a black belt in karate. So she was definitely a different kind of mom. And it's not surprising because her mom was different. Her mom never went to college, but worked her whole life and believed that women could be heard if they got involved in politics by, you know, being part of the grassroots and helping to get people elected. And then her mom was also quite a strong woman, was one of the first Rosie the Riveters, you know, working outside the home during World War II to help build big guns for the ships that were fighting.
And so your grandma was involved in politics, even though, as you
yes.
say, she was basically
came to it through more of an administration position, right? She was like basically a secretary in the Capitol. I'm just curious, like, did you from an early age see a future for yourself in politics, or did you, I mean, you went to law school, you did the lawyer thing for a while. Was there a moment where you thought as a younger child you might run for office?
I did. At about 7 or 8, I remember sharing with my sister and my cousin all what we wanted to be when we grow up. And my sister said she wanted to be an actress. And of course, she did become an actor. And then my cousin said she wanted to be a flight attendant, and she did not become a flight attendant. And I said, for whatever reason, I want to be a senator. And I didn't even know what a senator was, but I knew it was in public service. And I knew that that's what I always enjoyed my grandmother's efforts. I love the fact that she helped candidates and was involved in campaigns. And so I think my regard for her is what created that aspiration. And I'm sure I was thinking of a state senator. The only elected person we knew was a state senator.
Because you were in Albany?
Yeah, we were in Albany.
Yeah.
And it was Sam Stratton, and I just knew about him. But I knew that I wanted to be a public servant and have some role in making decisions and trying to help my community be stronger. And that was the way I talked about it. But I didn't admit that again for about another 30 years. So
I like it. I really did too. Not a congresswoman. A senator.
No, I just, yeah.
And it's, I mean, your entrance into the political world, I think, is so unique, coming really from a fundraising background. You know, you wanted to work on Hillary Clinton's run in 2000 for the Senate, and it took donating for you then to kind of get your foot in the door. Was it almost for you a perspective of whatever it takes to get that face-to-face meeting that you finally got?
Well, it's interesting. When I first got involved in politics, I was inspired because Hillary went to China, and I was an Asian studies major at Dartmouth. I'd lived in Beijing. I'd studied from the dormitory in Beijing. When she went to China as our first lady and gave her very famous speech where she called for women's rights as human rights and human rights or women's rights, I was kind of kicking myself because I wished I had been invited to that conference. And I realized I wasn't invited because I wasn't involved in politics. And so that's what sort of spurred me to get involved as an adult. And as I started to reach out to find out, how do I get involved in politics in New York City? I wasn't from New York City. I was from upstate New York. A friend's mom said, join this group of ladies called the Women's Leadership Forum. And so I realized to join this group, I had to pay a lot of money. It was like a $1,000 check, which was my rent check at the time. And so I paid the money and I went to my first meeting. And the first meeting was an event where Hillary was our guest speaker. And it was at that event in, you know, a very fancy club in New York City called the River Club. And about 100 women were in this very pretty living room. And she's looking out to all of us and saying, decisions are being made every day in Washington. And if you're not part of those decisions and you don't like what they decide, you have no one to blame but yourself. And for whatever reason, I thought she was talking to me. And I started to sweat and get nervous and thinking, oh no, she's telling me I have to run for office and I'm not ready. But sure enough, I did feel called. And it took about 10 years from that moment to actually run for office. But I used that 10 years to work on other people's campaigns.
And at the time, as Guy kind of alluded to, you did do a lot of fundraising. That was sort of your first entree into that. And I think one of the first big events you did was younger women doing this.
It was for Hillary. So what I realized when Hillary decided to run for Senate, that most candidates, what they want from you is to help them raise money, to help them raise the funds that are necessary to build a strong campaign. So when Hillary asked me, will you host an event with young women your age to help my campaign, I jumped at the chance.
Was it hard to reach out to women? Because I think that, you know, that's not always the most natural role for young women to be writing those checks, to be involved at that level.
Well, I was lucky enough that I was a lawyer at the time. So I had a very high income for a single woman. I didn't have anything to spend that money on. I wasn't trying to raise kids and put food on the table. I was just supporting myself. So I had quite a bit of discretionary income. And so what I did when I was asked to do this event, I called all the other young lawyers I knew from around the city and any other woman I'd met who had any interest in politics and said, let's do this for her. And we had 70 women on the host committee, so we were able to raise a significant amount of money.
And it was interesting that when the time came where you were thinking about running for Congress yourself, that it seemed like Hillary Clinton at that time, you know, you would reach out to her and ask her for advice and what she thought about you running. It seemed like her voice was one of caution, oftentimes saying, well, think about the impact it might have on your family. Think about
the poll numbers first, and you can win.
It was an interesting conversation. So the first time I thought about running was in 2004, but I just, had I even had Theo yet? I just had Theo. And when I was thinking about it, I think it was before I actually had, because I had Theo in November of 2003. And so I probably was talking to her before I actually gave birth. So,
and that first year of motherhood sort of like
is really hard. And so the funny thing was, is I was thinking about it because when you're pregnant, at least for me, I was on overdrive. Like there was nothing I couldn't do when I'm pregnant because I have to get everything done. It's kind of what expecting mothers are like. You're getting everything done. You're nest building constantly. And so I wasn't afraid of what that would be like, but she knowing full well, having been a mom and having lived through that time of her life, she just asked me a lot of questions. Well, what will you do with the baby? And well, that's a very Republican district. Have you thought about how you're going to, like, there was just very real structural questions about a very 2-to-1 Republican district. And I didn't know any of the answers. So I just kind of fumbled through this one phone call with her. And I decided afterwards that she never said, don't run. And she never said, you have no chance of winning. She just asked me questions I didn't know the answers to. And so after that, I decided I need to be more prepared. I'm not quite as prepared as I need to be. So I went to some campaign training schools. I met with a lot more political activists in the region, really did a lot more research, and also had Theo, and so was a parent and a mom for a year and a half, and so I sort of could get my handle on what's it like to be a mom and somebody maybe aspiring to run for office. And so by 2006, I called her again about the race, and I had sent her the poll that I had done to assess whether I could win this race, and she'd reviewed the poll, she'd talked to Rahm Emanuel already, she talked to several people, and so when she had a bunch of questions for me the second go, I actually had better answers.
And what made you decide to run in that district? Because you guys did move from New York City right to upstate, back to upstate New York, so, you know, in part to lay the foundation for this. And as you said, it was not the district you would naturally look at and go, oh, I can take out this Republican incumbent.
No. It was very hard, 2-to-1 Republican district, very red. The only person who thought I could win was actually my mother. So, and that was true. Well, I thought I could win, but that was about it. And, you know, when I was thinking about running and talking to my parents and friends, they just said, well, this seems like such a hard first race. You know, he's a very well-known, you know, politician who's been in office for 8 years, and George Bush thinks he's great and has a nickname for him, because George Bush also had nicknames for everybody. And he was Congressman Kickass, which was a nickname he got because he went down to stop the vote count in Bush v. Gore. Bush v. Gore, he was the head of the Brooks Brothers riot. And so people thought that just he seemed like a very rough and tumble opponent for a first-time candidate, and that they thought it might be a bit painful. But I didn't mind, and so one of the lessons my grandmother really taught me was not to be afraid, because you're just seeking the chance to serve.
I mean, for our listeners around the state, and Marisa kind of alluded to this, you didn't run in the Bronx and Brooklyn. I mean, we're talking about Otsego County, Delaware County.
It's very rural.
Very rural. And as Democrats, like in 2016 and 2018, really struggled in rural areas, that really held them back in a lot of gubernatorial races around the country. What's the secret sauce, if you have it, you know, for a Democrat to, you know, run and if not even win, really run competitively in a rural district?
I think the most important thing for any candidate, no matter where they're running, is to know why they're running, number one. And number two, understand the challenges that the folks you want to represent are facing. And that takes listening. So you really have to not only be from there, but have spent time there and listen to people about what their daily struggles are. And it's interesting, you know, the biggest issue when I ran in 2006 was the Iraq War. People were most angry about us being mired in Iraq, how many lives were being lost, and that it wasn't the best strategy to defeat terrorism, and it wasn't the best strategy to defeat al-Qaeda. It was not the right mission to do what our goals were. And so that was a huge issue that I ran on. But I also ran on some real bread and butter issues like Medicare for All. When I was listening to folks in the district, and you have to remember, this was 2005. Healthcare was still a huge strain on people. They couldn't afford it. And I said, well, what happens if you could buy into Medicare at a percentage of your income, a price you could afford, like 5%. And they would say, overwhelmingly, I would love that. That would just get me out from under the premiums and the co-pays and the deductibles. And I'd love to just know that I could get basic health care at a reasonable rate. And people still want the same thing. It's not changed. Because when you talk to anyone in New York State, even if you're in a rural area or in an inner city, the things they care about are the things that they're looking right at, their family, the things they talk about at the kitchen table. I'm worried about my mother because she's ill and, you know, we can't afford to, you know, have home care. I'm worried about my son. He has asthma. It's always about that life and death. How do I provide for my kids? How do I protect my family? And that's those issues in rural America are not dissimilar from what you'll find in a suburb or even in an inner city. It's just that you need to listen. And if you are doing that, you'll know what's on people's minds.
Well, one area that I think you have had a really strong evolution on is around guns. Mm-hmm. You had an A rating from the NRA when you first went to Congress representing this rural area. And then, you know, you did become appointed as a statewide senator. I think you now have an F rating from the NRA.
Yes.
Is that your only F in life? But talk to me about that, like, because that seems like that was probably personal, and I know you were close. You are close to Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman who was attacked, and you know, it just does seem like one of those issues where I think your critics would say maybe you flip flopped, and you probably have a different opinion on how you've kind of come to this place.
Well, you know, it was really quite. Personal and emotional decision. 9 years ago, when I was appointed to the Senate, I recognized that upstate New York didn't necessarily represent the same issues of the rest of the state because it's just a different lifestyle, different experiences. And one of the issues where I felt I might need to know more was what it's like to live in a place with, you know, very intense gun violence. And what happened to me was I went down to Brooklyn to meet with a family who lost their daughter, Nyasha Pryor Yard, to gun violence. And I not only met her parents, but I met her classmates. And to meet a community that was so destroyed by gun violence, by gang violence, it changed my perspective instantly. It wasn't a evolution. It was, I have to do something about this. This is not something I can ignore, and this is something I refuse to ignore. And so I decided when I heard these stories and understood how painful this was for not only her parents, but her best friends from school, I thought I have to do something meaningful. And so I talked to experts. I talked to Commissioner Kelly, who was the police commissioner at the time. I talked to Moms Against Gun Violence. I talked to a bunch of New Yorkers who had been really advocating for gun reform and listened. And I recognized that one thing I could work on was stop gun trafficking. Because in New York State, 90% of the weapons at the time were from out of state, and most of them were illegal. And so I thought if I at least could stem the tide of gun trafficking up from southern states to New York, right into the hands of criminals, that could protect more people, save more lives. And so I started to create a record on what I would do to end gun violence. And so it was a pretty quick decision for me based on the palpable pain that people are going through. And you know, for part of me, I should have realized that long, long before, but I didn't, so it wasn't a hard decision.
We saw this in the 2016 Democratic primary. It seemed like Bernie Sanders, coming from a rural area, had views in the past on immigration and on guns that ultimately came back to haunt him, I think, in the Democratic primary. As someone who is considering a 2020 run, do you feel like there's room for that in a Democratic primary, especially in a place like here in California, our primaries moved up? If there's room for people who in the past have represented rural areas and have different views on issues like guns and immigration?
I think that for anyone seeking any office, they just have to tell people what they believe in and why, and then the voters will decide, you know, do they share my values? Are they going to fight for me? Are they going to fight for my kids as hard as they're going to fight for their own? I mean, those are really the standards. Like, is this person somebody who can empathize with my life and understand how hard it is and do something to help my family's chances? That's what people want to know. And so I don't think it's a litmus test on where you stand on any given issue. But if you are so far outside their values, then they probably won't choose you as their candidate. And I think for gun violence, it's such a big issue for people around this country, and it's so devastating. And if you really look as to the reason why nothing's getting done, it's all about corporate greed. So I just think we should be doing more. And I think the lowest moment I've ever had in the Senate is when the Senate and the Congress decided to do nothing after Sandy Hook. And since then, we've had so many more mass shootings, so much senseless death. It's has to change. But I do think one of the bright moments of the political, one of the bright lights of the political moment that we're in is the fact that young people have taken over this movement. The fact that you have young women like Emma Gonzalez speaking out and saying, calling BS on every excuse every member of Congress gives her. I got asked today in one of my book events, you know, who's a modern day suffragist that, you know, we as students can look to. And I just named Emma. I said, she believes that she can change this thing by speaking out and by marching on Washington and organizing her fellow students around the country. And I agree with her. I think she can. I think she will change everything. But it's that passion and that determination that is the mark of how to change the world. It's how you do it. And so we do have modern day suffragists.
Well, you've spent a lot of your political capital encouraging and supporting women to run for office. I know that your group Off the Sidelines has raised like over $7 million, supported something like 100 candidates this time around. What's your assessment of what happened in November? Like, was it a pink wave?
Oh, definitely. And it was a lot of women who were very concerned about the direction this country is going in. And whereas they might normally just support someone who shares their values, they just put themselves right in there and just said, I will do this. I will run. I will make a difference. And they did. And so 120 women got elected to Congress, and a more diverse class than ever in the history of America. Two Muslim women won. Two Native American women won. We had women of color, huge numbers of African-American women running and winning, and a lot of disruptors, a lot of women, first-time candidates saying, I'm going to shake things up. One of the vignettes I put in the book is about the younger generation of suffragists who did exactly that, who shook things up. People like Ida B. Wells and Alice Paul and Mary Church Terrell were very much the new generation of suffragists who did things differently.
One other thing we did want to ask about is we've heard about the trash talking on the softball field. We hear
yes.
Not only are you an accomplished athlete, you are also an accomplished trash talker. So
it's true.
Given that, is there, you know, who is someone we might not expect in our U.S. Congress to be an equally effective trash talker who really brings it out when they hit the softball field? Or does no one match you?
Oh, no. There are many who are far better than me at trash talking. I would put in that group Sherry Bustos, for sure. I would also put in Debbie Wasserman Schultz, for sure. It's really fun. But I, you know, it's a great way to be bipartisan because, you know, Shelley Moore Capito is my third baseman. And I will always be grateful for her very strong arm. And it's really nice to have women in the Senate and the House from both sides of the aisle. It's a great, fun thing, the one light bit that we have in our day jobs.
Well, U.S. Senator Kirsten and Gillibrand, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That will do it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our engineers this week were Jim Bennett, Katie McMurrin, and Seal Muller. And special thanks this week to the team at City Arts and Lectures for hosting us for our interview.
Ethan Lindsay's our executive editor. He just walked by. And Holly Kernan is our chief content officer.
I'm Guy Marzorati. You can follow me on Twitter at Guy Marzorati.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at M Lagos. That's a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time.